collective insights as a voyage through topics and technologies revolutionizing human well-being. Groundbreaking approaches for a better world and a better life await you. Welcome to Collective Insights. Collective Insights and the work we do at Neurohacker Collective is made possible from the support of our community and the sales of our product, Qualia. Qualia is a comprehensive mental enhancement supplement designed to improve focus, mood, and flow state. Learn more about Qualia at neurohacker.com and use coupon code COLLECTIVEINSIGHTS for $20 off your first order.
Welcome to the Neurohacker Collective podcast, Collective Insights. My name is Daniel Schmachtenberger. I'm with research and development here at the Collective, and we are excited, delighted to have Dustin DiPerna joining us today. Dustin is an expert in the field of world religions and spiritual traditions in a way, bringing them to modern life in a way that is both scientifically commensurate and relevant to the application cases that people care about. He studied world religion at Cornell and then at Harvard, and then ended up studying with the Buddhist teacher Dan Brown, integral philosophy with Ken Wilber, and studying with many of the people at the cutting edge of the topics of human development, spirituality, meditation, etc., and has written a number of books in these spaces and teaches at Stanford School of Medicine in the health and performance department. And is not just versed in ancient practices, but also in relevant modern practices that are involving cutting-edge technology, neurotechnology-mediated meditation. And so we're really excited to have Dustin here to talk with us about what is possible in the space of human development and meditation and why it's relevant and all like that. So Dustin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Daniel. It's a pleasure to be here.
So to start, what is interesting in this space? What for an audience that is, some of our audience probably has never meditated, has only a vague idea of what it is. Some have maybe introductory familiarity, and some have deep spiritual practices, meditative practices. And for some, meditation is a spiritual practice. For others, it's a neurologic feedback process. Why is this an interesting area of study for you? Why is it interesting at a place like Stanford School of Medicine? Like, help us understand a little bit of what is the space and what's possible and what's interesting.
Great. So it's a fantastic question to start off with. I would say, Daniel, most of your audience is probably familiar with the fact that they can take supplements and those supplements can have a dramatic effect on their physical well-being. I would say that in a similar way, we can do particular practices or we can explore different aspects of our own mind in such a way that it has a dramatic effect on how we experience reality. And so I think from a basic starting point, I became interested in these kind of things because I was suffering. I was in a situation where I felt like my home life was chaotic. There was a sense that there was my parents were having affairs. My mother was an alcoholic. I needed to find a refuge. And I needed to do that in a way that was commensurate with my understanding of the world. And I wasn't a religious type person. So for me, doing something that was belief-based was not me. But doing something that I could try in my own direct experience that I could practice was very interesting for me. So I got turned on to meditation in my teens as a method to transform my experience of reality and also the ways that I could show up in more full and higher potential ways. So I think a good place to sort of frame things out for the audience is just to talk about technology a little bit. To talk about technology in an ancient sense, and to talk about technology in a modern sense. And I like to take a really broad swath of how I define technology. So for most people, they hear the word technology, they automatically think of our smartphones, or they think of, you know, social networks and things like this. But for me, technology has always existed. And there have always been ways that we as human beings have interacted with our world and have mediated our experience. And one of the things that I like to point out is that we've been using things like drumming or chanting or meditation techniques for thousands and thousands of years, maybe 40,000 years or more potentially. And so technology isn't new. And we've learned things over the past several thousand years that are still relevant today. Our mind and our human experience can be deconstructed in ways that provide incredible changes in consciousness. So there are three basic forms of technology when it comes to meditation that I like to point out. And I do this as a basic overview so that people can get a sense for what we're talking about. So most people, when they hear the term technology, they hear the term meditation, they're probably going to think about something like mindfulness, as mindfulness has taken this broad, it's had sort of a broad positive effect on our culture. But mindfulness is one very small category of meditation. And what mindfulness basically is the capacity, moment by moment, to turn your attention to an intended object. And as we begin to unpack that, we understand what that means. Mindfulness, or the basic forms of turning your attention to an object, fits into a broader category of meditation called concentration. So obviously there are applications of being able to concentrate and to be able to focus your mind in a way that can have positive effects in performance and many other things. We can go into details about that. But a second important category of meditation is a category that we call generative practice. This means that we have the capacity to intentionally affect the ways that we experience our emotional well-being and emotional states. We can generate states of positivity or generosity or kindness or love very intentionally through practices. That shows up not only for us, but for the people around us. And finally, the third category of meditation that I'll just name as a foundational framework are meditation practices that are called insight practices. And these practices begin to show us how we moment by moment construct our own experience of reality, how we create a subject and an object, how we put names, concepts, and forms onto reality. And when we begin to do those types of practices, those are the kind that can have the most radical effects on our worldview, how we interact with each other, how we interact with ourselves. So I would just say all of that as a form of technology that's always existed. Meditative practices are things that can mediate our experience in ways that we may have never dreamed of. And so they're not something that are belief-based. It doesn't matter your model of the world. They're something you can try out in your own experience, and you can see through evidence what works and what happens for you in your own life. So I'll hold that as a frame, but there's many different directions we can go from there.
So if we take a book like Waking Up by Sam Harris, where you have a neuroscientist who is famously atheist and focused on critical thinking, and has a physicalist model of the mind-brain interaction, conscious emergence from brain, he's still saying that meditation, that there are types of meditation that are relevant to increasing the quality of human life and human capacity. And that if you think about affecting the brain structurally through exercises that stimulate neurogenesis and create connectomic changes, whatever, cool. If you think about changing the brain chemically through the right types of diet and supplementation and whatever, but you can also think about changing the brain in terms of the software side more. And that might be in terms of what meaning making we're running, what processes of information processing and focus that we're running, that these are going to change our experience radically, and that whether we think that that's happening in a field of consciousness or a field of neural networks or kind of doesn't matter to the fact that there are things that tangibly do increase the quality of people's subjective experience if they apply them. They're exercises for affecting subjective experience.
Yeah, absolutely, Daniel. So I think a good build on that is that we know some things about concentration practice or focusing practice that we didn't know a decade ago. So because we have the capacity for fMRI or functional MRIs, we can actually take people who are in the process of focusing their mind, and we can track what aspects of the brain are lighting up. So we know for sure that when people are focused on a task and they're deeply concentrated, that the ACC, the anterior cingulate cortex in the brain, is lit up and is activated. And we can show this repeatedly over time. So whether or not someone believes that meditation works, or whether or not someone believes that consciousness is an epiphenomenon of the brain, actually doesn't make a difference, because we can show that the practice of meditation increases ACC activation, which therefore increases focus and concentration. Now, the reason this is important is because up until this point, we didn't have the neural correlates of what was happening when one was meditating. So it was always based on subjective experience. A person could say, I'm more concentrated or I'm more focused. And we know that in our modern scientific paradigm, subjective experience isn't always enough. But now that we have the neural correlates of what's happening in the brain, we can say, oh, we know the ACC has to do with concentration. We know that people who potentially have attention deficit disorder have a deactivated ACC, that Adderall is activating the ACC, so therefore there's some connection there. So as my one of my mentors, Dan Brown, says, the brain is an equal opportunity employer. It doesn't care if you take an Adderall or if you're doing concentration practice by focusing your mind. As long as you're activating the ACC, it's going to work. So in that sense, we take an agnostic perspective. It's not a belief-based perspective. It's agnostic and wants to see what actually gets results. And I think that's new. That's something new and available to us now like never before.
So given that we have the ability to do neurochemistry and animal trials and fMRIs, and during the time that Buddha was inquiring into these things, we didn't have even microscopes to see that there was microfunction happening in the brain. The brain looks like it's not moving, unlike the heart or intestine. So most people thought it was a cooling device for the blood. It's almost kind of fascinating that there were relevant insights at all. And yet what you do end up seeing is that just based on people's own introspection and phenomenology and paying attention to it and multiple people checking the experience, much of the development practices that came out of those traditions actually are being reified scientifically.
Exactly, Daniel. I think it's sometimes hard for us in our modern scientific paradigm to imagine a scenario that existed in a different place and time that could also be rational. So I often like to point out to people that just because we didn't have microscopes didn't mean that we were somehow irrational beings. So in a community of practice that perhaps existed 1,000 years ago in Tibet, for example, so I call Tibet the Silicon Valley of the mind. Now, so much innovation came out of Tibet, and so many practices came out of Tibet that we are still gaining from today. But if we just take an example, a group of practitioners in Tibet weren't just doing something that was belief-based. They were deeply rational. They would put a practice to a test. They would try it in their own direct experience. They'd compare it to the scientific literature of the time, which were these meditation manuals. They would then compare it with a community of the adequate, so a community of people who have done similar practices, and they would do research over time. So it's not as if before the microscope or before the scientific, sort of our modern science, it's not as if people were just sort of fumbling around, that we had very rational people who have done deep research into the nature of our own experience and the nature of the mind. So to me, it's not surprising. But I could see how someone from a paradigm that only knows the microscope and only knows our modern paradigm and perhaps projects into the past that people were irrational or pre-rational, that that'd be confusing. But for me, it makes perfect sense. And particularly as I experience more and more of these practices and realize, these things work, it gives me more and more confidence to look at them in a fuller and more detailed way.
So in terms of the neural correlates, the third person, what's happening in the brain versus the first person, here's what it feels like to be me and be experiencing this. The classic example of no amount of understanding the chemistry of a strawberry actually gives you any real sense of what the taste of a strawberry is like. And no amount of studying the brainwave patterns of 40-year Buddhist monks of a computational neuroscientist actually teaches them how to navigate the way they're or what the subjective experience is like. So even though they're correlated, they really are different types of knowledge. And so it's interesting to be able to do the third person objective science knowledge and the first person knowledge. And obviously eating a strawberry gives you a different insight into how to be a good chef, right? In terms of you get an intuition for how flavors will combine that you wouldn't get just from thinking about the chemistry abstractly of different foods. And so if we think about cultures where you had people that had the same types of brains we have today, meaning they had as much IQ intelligence capacity and classes of them, sometimes priestly classes, that dedicated their whole life to exploring the way we do as scientists, first person experience, and then sharing that with each other, that they might actually find a lot out about that universe that's novel.
Well, precisely. And Daniel, it takes a bit of humility for us to sit in our position now and to actually realize that there could be ancient wisdom that we have as yet to unpack in our own direct experience. And I think what's happening, this is why it's such an exciting time to be alive right now, is because the scientific literature and research capacities of things like fMRI, as we're speaking about, or even things like some of these technologies that do brain-mind interface. We have things like Think that does a transcranial stimulation. We can stimulate different parts of the brain. Or we have 16-channel EEGs that people can 3D print and to try on at home. We have all these different capacities that all of a sudden there's a lubrication that allows us to be a bit more humble because our methods are meeting the needs that we have as a rational culture, to then go back and say, wow, maybe there's more here than we had otherwise suspected. And so I think what you're saying is precisely right. And this time is rich because there is an incredible dialogue that's happening between the ancient and the modern. And it's certainly one of my interests, and I know one of your interests as well.
Okay, so when you said that part of what got you into these explorations was the desire to get out of suffering and figure out how to navigate your own subjective experience differently without being able to change the objective reality around you, right? Your parents were still going through what they were going through. Do you have to feel the same way, or can you become more sovereign in your internal state? And you said it wasn't going to be able to be belief-based. You wanted it to be empirical, right? Practice-based. But we do see the exact same story belief-based as the story of how most people find religion. If they're coming to it, right, they didn't grow up there. Most of the people giving a pamphlet on any religion that they're proselytizing said, hey, I tried everything else. It didn't work. I was suffering. And then when I accepted Jesus, Allah, whatever it was, things became better. And it was not necessarily about practice. For them, it might have been about belief. How do you put those together? Like, what happens for them? Is it actually better? Is the belief doing something that, like, talk to us about that.
Great. Well, I know that you had our friend Zach Stein on an earlier podcast, and Zach's been a dear friend ever since the days we shared at Harvard together. And we often have these conversations around development and what does it mean to develop as a human being? What are the potential unfoldings or stages of adult development? And some of these are well set, some of them are controversial, but it's an important place for us to start to answer your question, Daniel, and that and I'm going to use a broad sort of overgeneralized example because I think it'll be easier for your audience to understand rather than get too specialized. But we as human beings have the potential to move through several key stages of adult development. Not everybody moves through them. So at one of those earlier stages, what happens is that we source authority outside of ourselves. And so the person that you're speaking about, the sort of religious-based person who is interested in belief, often looks outside of themselves for what's going to work, what does a dominant culture say, what is the paradigm that I grew up in say, and they take it on without a lot of deep questioning. There's sort of just an inheritance of that particular belief system. But as we develop, we gain this capacity to begin objectifying our own belief systems. We begin to operate on our own belief systems like a scientist. And when we do that, we no longer source authority outside of ourselves. What we start to do is we actually base our own life mission on our own individual authority, on our own inner authority. We see individuals move through these. We see individuals throughout culture moving through these. And that shift is a really critical one because what it does, particularly in the context of religion and spirituality, is that if I'm in a stage where I'm now sourcing inner authority, it doesn't matter what anybody else says. I might use it as a reference point. It's like a hypothesis that a scientist gives, but I'm not going to believe that just because the authority said it's true. Mm-hmm. What becomes necessary is actually bringing that into my own experience, putting it into practice, and seeing what works. Mm-hmm. So it's true that belief can have a positive effect, but the way in which one's making meaning, whether it's externalized authority or internalized authority, is very different. And I would guess that most of the people listening to your podcast and involved mm-hmm. in this audience aren't interested in external authority. These are people who are psychonauts, or they're people who are explorers of what it means to supplement the realities and find what actually works. And that's my favorite audience to speak to because these are the people who actually are ready to try things out for themselves.
So I think this is a great distinction, and it's an interesting way to look at being able to separate the relevant from the irrelevant in religious traditions, where you had an element of religious traditions that were deep, esoteric, personal development, type practices that were based on real insights, real philosophy, real ethics, real development. And then you had the other chunk that was, how do you make in-groups cohere together in the face of war and political challenges and economic challenges, where they have a very real need to create in-group out-group dynamics. And so we read most of the religious texts, and there's lots of stories of war and, you know, certain groups winning holy wars against others. So then you, of course, have a lot of stuff that makes people that wants to make people believe and defer to authority for an actually evolutionarily necessary reason, right? So if you've got a person who was in a bad way, right, drunk and homeless, and then they accept Jesus, become part of a church, and all of a sudden they have community, right? They might now, and now they have job opportunities. They have safety and security at the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy. They have belonging. They have more esteem because they are doing better in their life because they have a support system, and they have some sense of direction. And then you have the placebo effect of belief is good for placebo, because just believing that you're on the right path, chilling out the worry and the self-generated fear dynamics, makes a big difference. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of, it's interesting how religions, from the point of view of them being in-group dynamics, kind of figured out how to work at every level of Maslow's hierarchy, where you had that need met if you were part of it, and you would certainly not have it met if you weren't a part of it, right? And this is an anti-defection strategy. And I think it's easy when one studies that and sees all the dreadful things done in the name of religion to want to throw the whole thing out.
Yep, absolutely. And this is why, Daniel, we make... Oh, please, if you weren't finished.
No, go ahead.
This is precisely why we make this distinction in religious studies and in a broader consideration between the exoteric and the esoteric. It's precisely what you're pointing to. That there are, in fact, exoteric examples that are more belief-based, that are used to set particular values and norms within a particular culture to create coherence. And there are esoteric practices that are actually used to transform consciousness. And what's been at the core of my work, and the reason that I've been so passionate about this particular topic, is because many of those esoteric practices are still alive in active lineages, where the esoteric practices have been passed from teacher to student to teacher to student in unbroken lines of transmission. And when you come in contact with esoteric practices that are in unbroken lines, there's a way in which that wisdom has been kept alive. And you're exactly right. It doesn't have anything to do with these more sort of in-group, out-group, war-based sort of initiatives. This has to do with what's possible as a human being that we can do with our own mind, whether it's yogic practice or whether it's exploring entheogens and psychedelics in a sacred context, or whether it's meditative practices or ways that we can use our breath in particular ways to open up transformative states. Whatever the technology, there are ways in which we can transform our experience. And that's really where I focus. So when we look at Maslow's hierarchy, as you pointed out, you know, as you know, there, at the top there was self-actualization. But then sometimes towards the end of Maslow's life, he actually said self-transcendence. And so what I'm really interested in are, what are the practices and the methods that we know from ancient history and that are emerging now today that can actually give us a sense of self-transcendence at the top of Maslow's hierarchy? So if in fact we have the other needs met, then what? Then what do we do? What does self-transcendence look like for an individual? Then in groups of people collectively around the world, what happens when self-transcendence begins to happen in group form? And what is the new potential that emerges when groups of people have all moved through a sense of self-transcendence? I think then we start to get in some very interesting territory, particularly when we combine it with some of these other technologies, whether it's neuroscientific technologies, neurohacker technology supplements, or brain-mind interface. There's some really interesting things that happen when self-transcendence meets modern technology, meets groups of people internationally on a world-centric or cosmocentric level of development. I think we're getting really close to that, and there are groups that are exploring it as we speak.
Okay, so I'd like to explore this distinction further. So before self-transcendence, all the other Maslow's hierarchy categories are pretty clearly relevant to everybody day to day, right? Like, they want to feel more secure, they want to be better at doing the actions that actually generate real security in their life financially and otherwise, but also being able to deal with their mind anxiety that creates unnecessary insecurity and et cetera, right? They want to know how to do relationships better and have a better sense of belonging. They want to have a better sense of esteem and self-worth, and they want to self-actualize. Now, there are meditative practices, development practices that are relevant to help all of that, right?
Yeah.
People can do practices that will actually make them psychologically better in ways that matter to them, performance better, et cetera. Then there is additional goals that people maybe don't even realize they have, right? The self-transcendence that is also there. So maybe talk about both. Talk about meditation and other spiritual practice, for lack of a better term, or if you have a better term, that are relevant to increasing the quality of the prosaic, right? Increasing the quality of all the things that people are already engaged in. And then, is there something else? And what is that?
Great. Wow. Such a fun question, Daniel. So let's start with these three categories of meditation. So one is focus or concentration. The second is generative practice. And the third is insight. So within the category of focused capacity, we know that activating the ACC can help us enter into flow states. It can help us enter into peak performance states. So someone who's deeply concentrated can give the full attention of their mind and presence into one particular task. They can shut everything else out. That's obviously going to lead towards higher performance in the world. So if part of our interest is to show up in the world to have higher impact or to be a more influential leader, then obviously developing the capacity for peak performance is going to be something we'd want to do, or if you're an athlete or something. So we definitely know that concentration meditations can lead towards those domains, which every individual could benefit from if they want to master a particular area of their life. The other one is that, let's say for belonging, for example, if you're using Maslow's hierarchy, if I do meditative practices that can help me become a kinder, more generous person, so a loving kindness meditation or meditation around how I can generate generosity of spirit, then I know that that's going to increase my social value in communities that I engage in. People will start interacting, having better a better impression of me. They'll do nice things for me. I'll do nice things for them. There's a sense of belonging that can develop that really has positive repercussions. This third category of meditation, insight, is where things get really interesting, because this is where that dimension of self-transcendence comes in. And I want to just as clear as I can say to the audience that self-transcendence isn't something that's only for a unique few people. That self-transcendence is a conscious or unconscious aspiration at the heart of every human being. And that the only way that you'll start to unpack that in your own life is by just being open-minded to the possibility that self-transcendence is also for you. That this isn't just something for people who are far away in some mountains or some caves. So what do we mean by self-transcendence? So self-transcendence, if I just speak really frankly, is that we can begin to understand that our own sense of awareness, our own mind, can actually move beyond an exclusive identification with our relative self. That means that Dustinness or Danielness isn't the end limit to who we consider ourselves to be. In one particular tradition, in say like a Tibetan tradition, for example, self-transcendence might be experienced as no longer understanding yourself to be limited to a physical body. So you obviously have a physical body, but the awareness of who you are is no longer limited to the skin, that the body itself is much more open, like space, without limitation, and that we begin to feel and experience the entire world as arising in that sense of self or within that body. When we start to have that experience, we move beyond the limitations of just being Daniel or just being Dustin encapsulated in the body, but we actually feel a deep sense of interconnectedness and interdependence with all of life in our direct experience, not just as an idea. These qualities of self-transcendence can have massive impact in the ways that we design our life, design our systems, the products we design, the technology that we design. So there are immediate implications. Once one has this capacity for self-transcendence, there's an impulse to want to share it with others and to create environments where others can benefit from it. And so let me, if I may, Daniel, let me just take an Eastern parallel. Because sometimes, you know, people are really comfortable with things like Maslow's hierarchy and things, but most people don't know that there are parallels that have, that are at least 8 to 10,000 years old that come from the Vedic traditions in India that talk about something very similar to that. So just to show a parallel. So within the Vedic or the yogic or the Hindu traditions, there's something called the aims of life, where they say that everybody has these sort of ways in which they try to seek happiness. And so this tradition says that we start by seeking happiness through pleasure, that we try to, you know, have as much sex as we can, eat delicious food. We want to create comfortable environments for our bodies so we're cozy. And that at a certain point, once one's achieved to a certain level, a satisfaction of that particular capacity, they realize that it doesn't bring happiness. And so what naturally happens is they move on to the next aim of life, which is the natural hierarchy of what emerges. And at that stage, people start to pursue money and power. So people start to say, if I just accumulate enough wealth, or if I accumulate enough influence and power, then I'll be happy. And as you and I both know, people who have moved through that, and even in our own lives, as we move through certain levels of abundance and capacity, that's also not ultimately satisfying. Sure, it's nice, just like pleasure is nice, but it doesn't create a sort of ultimate satisfaction. So many of us then move on to what this Hindu tradition says. We start to focus on how we can contribute to the world and make the world a better place. And so through, they call it dharma, through our contribution and service. In our modern parlance, we look at people who shift into the world like the nonprofit world, or the NGO world, or the world of social justice, and they want to have that impact. But as you and I both know, that also leads to burnout. There's ways in which that doesn't ultimately satisfy us because there are so many things in the world that we could work on that the list is unending of all the things we could do. And so the Hindu tradition says the only way that we can start to move into this next phase is by starting to focus on what is essential. And they claim that what's ultimately essential is liberation or self-transcendence. And it's only through self-transcendence that we'll find ultimate satisfaction. And so I give that as an ancient but parallel example to something like Maslow's hierarchy that your audience may be familiar with, just to say that, you know, we're sometimes reinventing the wheel. And if we learn and study what these ancient traditions have to say, there's a way that they're still very relevant to us. And so if, in fact, a tradition that's thousands of years old knows that self-transcendence is important, then, you know, it's also fair to say that they probably had a bunch of techniques and technologies that could lead towards self-transcendence. And that's precisely what I've given my life to, is studying those, resurrecting those, and sharing those with others.
Mm-hmm. So both Maslow's hierarchy and those aims are introductorily described as kind of progressive stages. So you go through seeking pleasure, then you go through seeking money and power, then you go through seeking dharma. Obviously, not everyone goes through them in the same kind of progression at all, right? Someone who's born into a social justice family might never end up seeking money and power that much, go straight into those areas, etc. But in the same way, it's, you know, and self-actualization is going to continue forever. Even after self-transcendence, one's going to continue to evolve as a embodied, unique human. And safety is going to keep being relevant forever, right? So there's a continuous development of all of those in parallel. And one of the things that's interesting to me is with regard to the self-transcendence part is as long as I'm doing all the other things for self, right? I'm going to get happy because I am doing good in the world, or I'm going to get happy because of I'm learning things, whatever, then there is this kind of tyranny of conditional happiness where it just sucks too much to suffer. And so if I think I have to do specific things to be happy, I don't really have much choice in that, right? And so I'm going to do those things because I have to do them, whether or not they're the most meaningful things. And so whatever it is, there's kind of an inherent narcissism that's built into seeking happiness, right? So one of the things that's been most meaningful for me in meditation practice early to make self-actualization and all the other parts happen differently is to say, can we actually generate a sense of wholeness unconditionally as the foundation? So then that's not what you're seeking everywhere. And then you can have a different basis for choice making. What is actually meaningful to me when I'm not just trying to get out of suffering and get the sense that I'm enough or I'm okay or I feel good?
So Daniel, you're a good example of this for your audience. I think you're an exemplar because you've already developed a community of trust, and there's a way in which people have trust in you. So in this conversation, that was the first time that I heard you speak about your own practice and your own experience. And I'd be curious if you would be willing to share in this particular context a little bit more about how you experience self-transcendence and how you think it's relevant to the people who could be listening to your particular podcast.
It's fun to flip the podcast around. I grew up on the sciences and on different philosophic and ancient traditions also, in terms of giving the benefit of the doubt that people who are thinking and exploring deeply might have interesting insights anywhere. Let's find it. I think probably similar in that. And that did mean getting to learn various traditional practices and practice them, you know, for some time. I think some of the things that have been meaningful for me, when you're describing self-transcendence and you said the sense of self as more than what's attached to the body, there's a belief system of that and there's an experience, which are very different. And the belief system says, I'm a soul and I'll reincarnate when I die or go to heaven, whatever it is, right? Or I'm spirit, or I'm an expression of the consciousness of the unified field, or there's a lot of different metaphysical ontologies, all of which are completely irrelevant to having the experience of the interconnectivity of everything. And you know, the way it kind of occurs for me that I can describe that's meaningful is this sense of what I think of as me that's associated with Daniel, that's associated with the body. This body depends on a lot, right? It depends on the atmosphere to exist. And if we didn't have this atmosphere, this body in outer space doesn't do anything, right? It's just instantly gone. And so the atmosphere depends on all the plants and the algae that create it. And so I say, who am I without all of the plants? I don't exist at all. So any concept of self that doesn't include the plants and the algae is nonsense. And then they don't exist without the bacteria and the fungus that make them possible, and the pollinators and gravity itself that makes the whole planet possible, and electromagnetism itself and the nuclear forces and on and on, right? And I come to recognize I my personal sense of self as a separate concept, if I don't factor its relationship with the rest of the universe, is a nonsense concept because it doesn't exist at all without the rest of the universe. So then I become an emergent property of all of universe rather than a separate thing. And that doesn't mean just homogeneous oneness, right? Because there's obviously still distinctness, but inseparability. Can't take me out of the biosphere and have me be interesting, right? Have me exist. Can't take me out of the laws of physics or anything else. And so then we say, all right, rather than say consciousness is an emergent property of brain, consciousness is actually an emergent property of all of universe interacting in this way, my experience of consciousness is. And so then what that lends itself to, and it's understanding that is actually useful, to kind of scientifically understanding that and also experiencing it. And I think a lot of people, not as many people have meditated enough to have that experience, but a lot of people will get to take mushrooms or LSD and have a really quick dive into, holy shit, I actually feel a sense of connectivity with everything, which is awesome. Yeah. And if that inspires them to start a practice where they stabilize that so that they don't just experience that when they're intoxicated, but they can access that at will, then it as a tool that can both inspire and guide a practice is something that I love. But as soon as someone has a sense of self as an emergent property of everything, then the idea that I can advantage myself at the expense of anything else that my life depends on, that I don't exist without, that my consciousness depends on, becomes nonsense. And so nonviolence doesn't just become an ethic, it actually becomes the only rational way of being. And what's best for me, what's best for the whole, become the same thing. And so it's interesting to see how one's basis for choice radically changes when their understanding of self changes.
Yeah, and if you look at, Daniel, the ways in which our current systems and the current scenarios that we find ourselves in have been built without that understanding. So in fact, they've been built from a paradigm of separation and extraction and total isolation. Then, and we see how certain aspects of those systems are not working. In fact, as you would say, they're moving towards sort of an existential crisis. Then there is a way in which this shift into self-transcendence actually becomes necessary.
Definitely.
For our own survival as a species, not just something nice for a few people, but actually critical, mission critical for our survival. And I think that's where things get really interesting, is that all of a sudden at this point where it's now becoming more and more available, we have technology that makes it more and more accessible. We have the neuroscience that actually say there's something legitimate going on here. All these things are triangulating in a way that give us the potential to spread this experience for self-transcendence en masse.
Yeah.
Just at the time when it's absolutely needed that we begin to shift and adjust systems so that they're more aligned with a deeper understanding of reality and a deeper understanding of self than we've had previously en masse. And I think that's a really interesting moment that we're in. And I know that deeply connects to your own work.
It does. Yeah. You know, one way that I think about the exploration of the space of subjectivity and consciousness and first person experience, most people who haven't studied mathematics very deeply have no concept how much math exists that they don't know, right? Like maybe they got to trigonometry or calculus, and so they know that they don't know integral calculus, but they don't even know that they don't know quaternions because they never even fucking heard about quaternions, right? Or whatever aspect of higher mathematics that they haven't studied. And as one learns more math, they also learn more new adjacent areas they didn't know about. The unknown unknown grows even faster, right? And they start to become more knowledgeable and more humbled and fucking awed at the same time, because the space is just immense, right? And so deep and so profound. And the beauty of it, the possibility of it, most people will never even become aware that they don't know. Right, they'll never even become aware that it's a thing at all. And consciousness is like that, where, and it's easy if you are just completely unaware that there is even that realm of space to just dismiss it as not real or not interesting. And yet, as someone starts to explore the practices and within mindfulness, you start to recognize, oh, there's some possibility here, and it opens up. Where does attention arise from at all? And what happens when I put my attention on the source of where attention arises from? Holy shit, a whole new thing just opened up. And again and again. And so to explore that universe, and I think part of why it's interesting is because both what it does to increase human capacity and human disposition, right? Like ethics ends up emerging automatically without a mental construct from a sense of interconnectedness and from a sense of wholeness that isn't needily grasping for getting stuff from life. But also even just a sense of fulfillment and joy, the kind of the upper level of positive subjective experience most people are touching is just scratching at the surface of the possible. And the areas that they're pursuing more is just not going to happen. You get diminishing returns. And so, you know, why I'm so grateful that you are doing the work you are and people in the field are doing the work they are is because for that whole universe of possibility to live where it's really only available or even known about to a very few people, one, it's just a bummer, right? Mm-hmm. And two, it actually is, as you were mentioning, existential at this point, because, you know, this is a narrative that is kind of core to, for me, is that exponential technology is giving us exponentially increasing power to affect the world.
Exactly.
Fishermen previously, for all of human history, didn't have mile-long drift nets that they could just take all the fish out of the ocean, right? And people fighting with spears didn't have nuclear missiles that were intercontinental that could kill all life. And people thinking about things didn't have AI systems that could be trained to beat humans at all finite games and could get out of our control space, right? So we're just reaching the verticalizing part of the exponential tech curve. And what that really means is, like, in a mythopoetic sense, that we are developing the power of gods. When you look at Hiroshima, it was a bigger explosion than the descriptions of Zeus's lightning bolt in literature, right? Like, and it's a small bomb compared to the ones we have now. Like, literally, we're developing the power of gods. But without the love and the wisdom and the awareness and the prudence of gods, with that power, you just self-destruct. And so we are not on the curve right now as clearly, as eminently, to have the love and the wisdom of gods as the power, but the power forces us to get there or self-destruct.
Right. I was a few years ago, Daniel, I was in a small private interview with a Tibetan meditation teacher, a Rinpoche. His name was Rahab Tolku Rinpoche. And when I was sitting with this teacher for the first 5 minutes, we didn't say anything. You know, we just sort of looked at each other. And after about 5 minutes, he spoke in his like beautifully sort of broken Tibetan English, but he was so crystal clear. He just looked at me and he said, "We've gone through massive technological revolutions. And humanity understands that technology in a short period of time can massively shift and it can affect every human being. We've fallen way behind on consciousness and the fact that consciousness can go through the same types of revolutions that technology has and the same types of exponential growth curves. So it's the task that we have right now to help consciousness catch up with where technology is." So it's precisely to your point, Daniel, like, we now have atomic weapons and we have the capacity to destroy millions and millions of people with one particular weapon, which the asymmetrical power has never been like this before. Unless we actually have the consciousness rise to meet us, to give us the inherent ethics that you were speaking about, not a prescriptive ethics, but a descriptive ethics that arise from the natural sense of interconnectedness to go with this asymmetrical power for destruction, we're in bad shape as humanity. And so, you know, my hope with podcasts like this, the work that you're doing, with the work that I'm doing, is that we can help give people the frameworks that at least let them know what's possible and at least let them know that there are areas of growth and development that perhaps are in the unknown unknown for some of these people, that there are areas of growth that perhaps can become, you know, unknown known. So now they know that they don't know, which would be amazing. And if people can move into the space that, wow, now I know that I don't know about something, there's potential to then know about it. And if we can help make that shift, and if conversations like this or others can make that shift, you know, hopefully we're moving in the right direction.
Okay, so let's talk to me about how something meaningful here is actually viable for people in the modern world and scalable. So just to frame the problem space.
Yeah.
So most people who are engaged in their own life, and in the process, they're engaged in buying things from supply chains that are externalizing harm across the world, driving climate change, driving species extinction, having trade dynamics that create international tension that increases the chance of war, et cetera, right? And that, and even as they're trying to do potentially positive for-benefit companies or nonprofits or whatever, the just economic movement that is implicit in it is driving the underlying harm externalizing dynamics that makes that economic system possible. And they're being conditioned by that, right? If the other company is outsourcing all of its work to the third world and they don't, they just lose because they can't compete economically. So then they have to do that and they have to rationalize why doing that is appropriate to do the good they want to do, right? So they've got that going for them, against them. And Facebook and Google are clickbait optimizing their mind for pressing the like button, scrolling a lot, and you know, no focus and kind of massive dopamine addiction that's starting younger and younger, right? To where kids growing up with iPads have their whole connectomics of their brain being blue light 2D clickbait optimized. And people are busy as fuck and they need to work more to make money to have some security in times where economy is as uncertain as it is. And if they had any more time, they don't spend enough time with their family, their kids, whatever. And if they had any more time, they don't exercise enough as it is or sleep enough or eat healthy. And now we're saying there's this whole other area of stuff. Like, okay, so what is actually possible for people in that context and relevant? And what is the triage of where they should start?
Wow, good question. You know, I think there's different types of people, and there's not going to be a one sort of uniform, homogeneous answer for every single person. But let me name a few places that people could start. So, and let me say a little bit about where, you know, people that I know closely, where they got their start. You mentioned it already. And this isn't an endorsement, but this is just to say, describe the field of experience and what's happening. Oftentimes people get introduced to this whole domain through psychedelics or entheogens. Mm-hmm. And they have some sort of initial experience where, you know, we have great research that shows us that psilocybin can potentiate mystical experiences. And we have a massive group of people who are working with medicines that have come from the Amazon, like ayahuasca. And we have people who are, you know, working with venoms that come from toads, the Sonoran Desert Toad, and working with DMT. So we have a massive amount of exploration. What's happening with many of these people is that they have an initial experience that shows them that something is real beyond what their usual framework or their usual sense of self tells them was real. And those opening experiences are sometimes some of the most powerful gateways or on-ramps to then recognizing, wow, this is actually worth my time, attention, and energy. So let me just use that as one broad category of how people are on-ramping themselves, self-initiating. The second category is through starting a basic meditative practice like mindfulness that you mentioned earlier. So we know for sure that as people begin to download apps like Headspace and others, and they begin to start a meditation practice, they actually start to see reductions in stress and anxiety and all the usual things. But people who go a little bit further begin to realize, just as you said earlier, you can start to turn attention back on itself and say, where the heck is attention even coming from? What is attention? What is awareness? We start to open up deeper possibilities in our own experience. So another category would be starting some sort of meditative practice. And I always recommend, if possible, trying to study within a lineage of practice where there's actually a checks and balance amongst teachers and there's tried and true practices that we know work. So that's always my recommendation. A third category that I think is awesome and very underemphasized is beginning to understand what happens when we're sleeping and dreaming. So we spend a third of our life asleep, you know, on average, you know, maybe more or less given your sleep cycles. And our dream world is such an amazing experience. We literally go to sleep every night. We have these crazy, far out, wild experiences. And then we wake up as if it was totally normal because everybody's doing it. And in fact, I mean, it is normal, but it's crazy. It's amazing what happens. And I would just like to plant the seed that we have great research in the West around lucid dreaming, starting with Stephen LaBerge out of Stanford, and we have great research from Eastern meditative traditions about what's possible with sleeping and lucid dreaming. And I would just say that it's possible to begin to wake up in your dreams, to recognize that you're dreaming, and then to consciously and intentionally interact in your dream state. One simple way people can do this is to start a dream journal, make sure that people are you're remembering your dreams, and then throughout the day, just ask yourself, am I dreaming? Every time you see your hands, ask yourself, am I dreaming? If you do that in a regular way for a week or two, naturally what will happen is that in your dream state, you'll see your hands and you'll say, am I dreaming? And you'll say, oh my gosh, I'm dreaming. You'll wake up in your dream. For me, lucid dreaming, giving people an example of what's possible, it's phenomenal. Everybody's dreaming anyways. Use that as an opportunity to recognize that there's way more than we understand happening. And so if you can develop a practice around lucid dreaming, you're not taking anything away from your everyday life. You're already pushed to the max, your kids, food, working out, but you're dreaming anyway. Mm-hmm. So why not use that time in a way that can really be transformative? So I say these are the three major ways I see people on-ramping, self-initiating through psychedelics, entheogens, some sort of meditative practice, or through actually using the dream state as a way that could be an opening experience. Very accessible, and there are people using all of those.
I think that's great. Those are probably the main on-ramps. Maybe one other one I would see is retreats, because someone can kind of compartmentalize it off from their life and just have the time that is, you know, where there's a container that has discipline. And that's kind of like psychedelics, right? There's some very deep state induction where now they're motivated to continue to explore because rather than just hearing the idea, they experience something really incredible.
That's right. And if we want to like turn the gears down a little bit, the other one I often offer on like a front end that's not quite as extreme as any of those is to just travel. I mean, if people aren't traveling in their lives, if they're not being exposed to other cultures and places in the world, to whatever degree, it could be a different part of the U.S., a different state, but getting out of your usual conformist view of what's real and getting exposed to another conformist view of what other people think is real and the shared values they experience, that in itself can be really amazing. So traveling, and then as virtual reality and augmented reality comes online, I think that's going to offer us another vector that we'll really want to explore as an on-ramp as well.
Definitely. Okay, so coming to an integral framework for a minute, the wake up, grow up, show up framework. Would you speak to that a little bit? Because there's different practices for each of those, and they're all relevant, and none of them are kind of replaceable for each other. And I think that might be a valuable framework for people.
Sure. So I originally started using these four phrases about 10 years ago. So it was wake up, grow up, clean up, show up. And in this domain, we have a way that we can begin to understand the various areas of human growth. And so when we talk about waking up, we're really talking about this capacity for self-transcendence, this capacity to move beyond the limited or exclusive identification with Daniel or Dustin or our bodies into this more understanding ourselves as an emergent principle of reality, interconnectedness, and with a base of wholeness. We start from wholeness and we act out our uniqueness from wholeness. It's really what this waking up dimension is about. And I want to say, just as a side note, that you mentioned this earlier, that waking up isn't just the state experience that's temporary. Waking up can be something that can be trained and stabilized as a permanent attribute of one's experience. Mm-hmm. So self-transcendence doesn't have to be just a peak, but can be something that becomes a persistent experience over time as a view or an experience of reality. So I want to emphasize that we're not just talking about one-off hits, but there's a trainable capacity of stabilization that's possible for every single human being. And that's what we mean by waking up, not just a state experience, but a continued ongoing experience of waking up.
Just a real quick thing to share there that I think is a fun story and people will appreciate. And I actually don't know the historical details of this, but it's a nice story nonetheless. When our kids are asking, going through the phase of asking, what is that? What is that? What is that? What is that? Which they're trying to understand the anatomy of universe. And we say, that's a dog. That's a mountain. That's a person. There was a Native American tradition, and I don't remember which one, that said, that's the one spirit reflected as a dog. That's the one spirit reflected as a mountain. That's the one spirit reflected as your uncle. And so they got the wholeness and the interconnectedness first in their foundational semantics and their foundational ontology, and then the unique expression second. So they got the expression, right? They got mountain, dog, human, but not separate first. And you think about, just from the point of view of waking up, what waking up is like when you're coming from a place where you've been conditioned into separateness the whole time first, versus what it could be like with a different educational system and a different parenting system, where that's just implicit in the process of coming into life.
Exactly. And I think what's so beautiful about that point, Daniel, is that waking up is something that is almost like a pre-existing condition, in the sense that it doesn't have to necessarily be earned over time, but it's always already the case. And so we can begin to point out and build into our language and into our education systems this principle of waking up, or this principle of undivided wholeness from the very beginning. So I'm totally in agreement with you. So if we have wake up, grow up, clean up, show up, grow up would be the second category. And growing up is probably very similar to what your previous guest, Zach Stein, spoke about, where there are actually very clear developmental levels that we can move through as human beings. And as we move through those levels, we increase our capacity for complexity, for care, for inclusivity. And so the example I gave earlier of authority shifting from an outer authority to an inner authority is one of the ways in which we can grow up. We grow up by beginning to inner source authority rather than outsource it. There are many other models we can use, but just so you understand, that's this domain of growing up. And one of the best ways to begin to understand how we can grow up together is by simple practices of perspective taking. we can begin to understand, how many perspectives am I actually taking? Do I understand what someone else is experiencing? Do I understand what they're experiencing about someone else's experience? We can begin to fractalize our capacity for complexity. Or can I think about what I'm considering right now and then take a view on that particular view? And then can I look at the system in which that's embedded? And can I look at all the dynamics that's unfolding within that system? So there's a way in which we increase our capacity for holding more and more while including all the previous skills that we had. That's just the domain of growing up. And there's great research on that. We can, you know, at any point in time, go into that deeper. Cleaning up is
interesting. I'll add a fun note there that I learned from a mutual friend of ours, Clint, over at in the Integral World, that when he was looking at doing his PhD research and looking at higher stages of development, and it had been previously thought that it largely had to do with perspective taking, the ability to take others' perspective, he found that an even deeper correlate was perspective seeking, not just the capacity to take another perspective, but the impulse to do so. Exactly. And that one is actually oriented to be continuously seeking to look through all perspectives. I thought that was a actually really nice distinction.
Yeah, absolutely. And we also, I mean, there's other even oversimplified but easier ways for your audience to understand is that, you know, we move from more of an egocentric world view to an ethnocentric world view where we just care about our tribe, to a world-centric view where we actually understand that, you know, we're all human, to maybe a cosmocentric world view where it's even beyond. So there are ways in which we can understand nested hierarchies of growth in all kinds of different ways. So that's one example. So cleaning up is interesting. So in both waking up and growing up, things can go wrong. There are ways in which we can experience trauma, and we can experience aspects of ourselves that aren't welcome into our life circumstances or into our frontal personality that we push aside, we push into the shadows. So there's a whole dimension around healing and integration that in the West, our psychotherapeutic traditions are excellent at. In indigenous cultures, there are particular medicine work that's really effective at cleaning up and integration and healing. But this whole domain is one in which if we leave it out, we'll end up with people who maybe have some sense of awakening or some sense of being grown up, but in certain aspects they're broken and they have shadow elements or some aspects of themselves that are acting out in ways that are actually damaging. So we have to include that cleaning dimension.
We're in the post-Me Too phase right now where this kind of massive breakthrough is happening where Silicon Valley VCs, producers in Hollywood, diplomats and politicians in DC, and people who were previously like the examples of family values are all sexual predators or in some form sexually inappropriate. And it's like such a great example of that. These aren't people who didn't have any authentic development, right? They obviously developed real capacities and yet parts were fragmented enough, but to see how ubiquitous that is, right? That's exactly. Like we have a culture that has pretty much made fragmented people in ways that are dangerously fragmented ubiquitously.
Exactly. And, you know, obviously you see as a culture the aspects that we have a culture have pushed aside, like sexuality and other things, or gender relations. And this gives us a chance to actually liberate those on a cultural level in addition to an individual level. So we can do this cleanup work as groups or as individuals. And we see that happening with the Me Too, just like you're describing. And then the last broad category that would stem from an integral framework would be this category of showing up. And so not just waking up, growing up, or cleaning up, those are all important, but how does it actually show up in our lives and how do we show up in the world to actually make an impact? And if any of these dimensions are left out, then our showing up in the world is going to be a little bit, it could be a little bit kinked. It could be a little bit, it could lack flow. It could lack impact. It could actually affect people in negative ways or unintended ways. So at a minimum, waking up, growing up, and cleaning up and showing up are the four categories that we'd want to include in any sort of integrative approach to our own lives and our own development. And with that framework in place, we can work towards what Ken Wilber and I have called a deliberately developmental civilization. That as a civilization, as a whole, we can begin to understand what it means to develop as human beings, and we can include the broadest swath of categories that we'd have to include at a minimum if, in fact, we were to create a civilization in which we all move towards a non-existential crisis and instead to an existential potential, you know, dream realm that we all can only hope is possible.
Beautiful. So This is a good introduction. I'm really happy that we got to share this. So if people want to get tangible resources where they can find an integrated approach to wake up, grow up, clean up, show up, or where they can find specific ways of studying lucid dreaming, psychedelic resources, mindfulness, any of the things we've mentioned, what are some resources for people?
Great. So because I spent so much of my life working on these particular topics, obviously I want to recommend some of the books that I've worked on. So Streams of Wisdom is one of the books I've written that really takes a comprehensive view of all these things, waking up, growing up, cleaning up, psychedelic work, technology, neuroscience, and integrates these dimensions. On my website, dustindeprena.com, Ken Wilber and I have a white paper there. It's free to download, where we speak about a deliberately developmental civilization, where we're tying in some of these key aspects. And then I've been really impressed with the work that Mikey Siegel's doing at Consciousness Hacking. So for those people who are interested in sort of the technology interface with consciousness and meditation, check out Consciousness Hacking work. Mikey and I teach a retreat twice a year at Esalen Institute, where we actually hook 24 people up to technology. We have galvanic skin response, heart rate variability, breath sensors. We create group flow experiences through sound and through light and through using all these sort of biofeedback elements. We combine ancient traditions with the most cutting edge modern technology. So that's a great resource for folks. And then Daniel, honestly, your podcast, I just know the people you've interviewed, and I think I would tell your viewers or listeners to keep staying up to date with what you're doing, because I know that you're at the edge and you have a great network of people. And I just want to thank you for bringing me onto the show and for having the dialogue. So thank you very much, Daniel.
It was such a delight. This was a really fun initial conversation. And I just want to invite the listeners that if there's anything that's particularly interesting that you'd like to go deeper into with these topics, send us messages to customer service. And whether it's shadow work or the cleanup stuff around how do we actually deal with what makes sexual predation at a cultural level and how would we fix that, or whether it's around psychedelics or technological tools for modern tech tools for meditation or anything, Dustin might be willing to go deeper into those areas if we have specific questions.
Sometimes it's a little bit of a tease to just stay like sort of on the surface here, but oh man, any of those, Daniel, it'd be such an honor to go deeper with you on, and if the audience is interested.
Thank you so much for being here and for the work that you do, and looking forward to connecting more soon.
Great. Thank you.
Take care.
Want to learn a better strategy for mental well-being? We designed a beautifully illustrated 32-page guide integrating care for your mind, brain, body, and environment into a balanced approach for a better life. Download the foundational guide to neurohacking at neurohacker.com/guide. Thank you for listening to Collective Insights. For the full show notes on this episode and for more great interviews, visit us at neurohacker.com/collective-insights. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the podcast and leave us a 5-star review on iTunes.